Joe, how are you doing?
Just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very good. Glad to be back here talking. This week, I thought we'd discuss, and I think you agreed, this past week, Ken Burns has another documentary, this one on the Vietnam War. Of course, Ken Burns, famous for his treatment of the Civil War back in the 90s. He, of course, did a thing on baseball back in the mid-90s. He had one on jazz, I think. He also did one on the Great Depression and the Second World War. And so now he's tried to analyze or present to the American people a documentary on the Vietnam War. So you had a chance to see it. I haven't had a chance to see it. I just read some reviews of it. I'm not too surprised given Ken Burns' past and the type of work he produces. It's usually he produces some variants of the standard narrative, maybe with a slight twist on it. And documentaries are usually artfully done. But again, it is something that does produce support the standard narrative of the Vietnam War. You've actually seen some of it. What's your take?
I watched about 4 hours of the thing, which for me is really straining the brain. I hated it and, hate him. I think that, someone like Burns basically has either direct instructions or, I'm not even sure how they can train people to be like this, but what the thing does, what the documentary does is it just basically sucks all of the emotion out of the viewer who's watching it. There's lots of emotional moments and but they always kind of reduce the war to something that's incomprehensible. I mean, that's really the main theme that's kind of underlying all of the footage that he's assembled and with his weird camera technique where he takes a still photograph and then moves the camera around or zooms in and zooms back. It just makes me nauseous when he does that. But I think that's just part of the mind control. But he just comes to point after point where, this series of bad ideas and it's ended up with all these people dead and there just isn't any real response to it. It's just history unfolded. It was crap. And now it's time just to be calm and carry on. That would be my sense of what the Vietnam War is, the series is supposed to do. There was a couple moments that actually kind of piqued my interest, and one of them was John Kerry's speech to the Fulbright Commission while the war was still going on. And this was interesting because, Kerry is a skull and bones guy. He went to Vietnam just to build up a war resume so that he could run for political office. And then incredibly, when he comes back to this organization of veterans against the Vietnam War, which has about 20,000 people in it, he is the one who somehow is selected to address the Senate committee. I mean, isn't that amazing? What an incredible coincidence, that... here you have a skull and bones guy addressing basically a roster of Freemasons who are senators about this incredible tragedy of the Vietnam War. And Kerry goes through a list of things that are bad about it. The thing that I was wondering if Burns would ever actually kind of even hint about the stench of the secret society that just lays on top of the Vietnam War. And he never did a single time. And he obviously could have done it there because, you have the real architect of the war was McGeorge Bundy, who was a Skull and Bones guy. It had been set up to a large extent by the Kennedy assassination, which was just a complete Skull and Bones operation, from Bissell and Dulles. Dulles wasn't Skull and Bones. But Dulles, his family, it's interesting, people, need to look a little deeper than that. Dulles's family was actually in the original Skull and Bones. People don't know this, but there was actually a secret society in Yale that existed before Skull and Bones. I forget what the name was. I think it was the Lords of the Soup Kitchen or something. But what happened was it was basically understood as a Freemason institution, and then there was some hue and cry against Freemasonry, and everything went underground. And when Skull and Bones came back up, it was a way of just, kind of not letting the public know what was in back of the, back of the organization. But so in any case, you had a possibility that, here you've got so much secret society. You've got Kerry, you've got McGeorge Bundy, Bissell, the architects of the Kennedy administration. You're going to end up with the Freemason, Gerald Ford, basically putting the quash on the whole thing. Why isn't this something that Burns could bring up? And then the other time, well, and I think it's clear, it's because he's there to quash speculation about, why the war was run. But the other time when Burns really went sideways on something that could have been important was when he covered the Gulf of Tonkin. Because, well, first of all, he doesn't really explain how clear a false flag the thing was. I've actually listened to the radio tapes of the event, and it was clear that everyone knew that there was no North Vietnamese action. The way that Burns presents it, it's just this unclear fog of war. The Joint Chiefs wanted a war, so they were willing to look at the information one way, but there's another way to look at it. But the fact is that it was a complete nothing burger as far as a North Vietnamese attack, and they just made it up. But the point, so Burns doesn't, really go into that much. But what really was important in terms of, kind of exposing Burns is that he doesn't mention the admiral in charge of the Navy task fleet, who was Jim Morrison's father. And this was really, awkward, because Burns uses the rock and roll music throughout the entire series. Mm-hmm. You start out with Bob Dylan, but he'll cut to, like the Birds and Grateful Dead. So you've got like a soundtrack that comes in and out of the, about the Vietnam War. And particularly when he covers the protesters, he's got the long haired guy, and he'll have, the Birds playing in the background and folk rock and stuff.
Yeah. And also in Apocalypse Now, I think the Doors music plays a prominent role in the movie Apocalypse Now. I'm sorry.
Great minds think alike. Okay. I was just going to mention that the end, yeah. The creepy Book of Revelation Freemasonic anthem of the Doors was used by Coppola for his creepy apocalyptics Book of Revelation Apocalypse Now, which is based on the absolutely insane Heart of Darkness by Conrad. I haven't brought out this particular piece of analysis, but rest assured, it's just a nightmare Freemason. I mean, it's like if you've ever seen the analysis I've done of, Catcher in the Rye, mm-hmm. Heart of Darkness is almost this bad. It's just a very thinly veiled, cryptic, kind of homage to Freemasonry destroying civilization. And so Coppola uses it as the basis, he's paying homage to this. And then he actually lights up the film with The Doors, The End, This Is The End. And anyway, so the fact that Burns doesn't mention this is a little peculiar because he has the folk rock, you know, part of the rebellion so, prominently displayed in his video. And it would have been an absolutely natural moment, right, to juxtapose Jim Morrison with his father, right? Mm-hmm. One person is the admiral, the other is the LSD-promoting rebel. But he doesn't, and I think it's because they really don't want the public to have that data point circulating in their mind. And it would cut against what Burns is really about, which is basically just subtracting all emotion and really all possibility to even think about the war. I mean, it's kind of hard to describe how he treats the conclusion of his trains of thought and his little pieces of narration where he takes a little vignette and, you know, he covers one person for a few minutes and then person dies or disappears. But he just has a way of everything fades to gray, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Every single thing that he covers, you know, there's, you know, very interesting moments and, you know, there's a lot of violence and, you know, amazing explosion. And then, of course, there's all this concern about, well, why are we doing this? You know, the question keeps coming up. But at the end, it's always just fade to gray. And I think that's really what the purpose is of basically historical documentaries, you know, is just to subtract the emotion from the population. Obviously, there's still some people who are bitter about the war. If you can reduce them to basically a medicated state, and that's how I would characterize Burns's, his documentary is it's like a kind of video med. You know, it's just to take you to a place of like a debased tranquility. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, that was just my overall impression of the thing, is that it avoids everything that could produce any real thinking, and particularly it avoids the natural stench of the secret society. I mean, if you look at from Kennedy's assassination to Gerald Ford's conclusion of the war, you get the secret society is in absolute control all the way through. And at the end, then you just fade to gray. You know, they have a lot of audio tapes. Kissinger and Nixon are talking. Nixon and some of his, his henchmen are talking. And in my opinion, all of the dialogue is scripted. I listened to it carefully, actually, because I have it on Apple TV. I could run it back and forth. And I think that all of the Kissinger-Nixon conversations are basically being done as with the idea that the tapes will be released to history. Mm-hmm. And the dialogue is just so artificial and weird. I don't think any humans would talk like this. So they're just reading from a script, and they're just trying to create a, you know, impression like they're tortured. That they're struggling with these great decisions, like LBJ, you know, it's like they have some audio of him where he's struggling. Oh my gosh, I don't know. What am I going to do? But here's the basic truth, Tim, my opinion. They damn well wanted to kill every single person that they killed over there. And they probably, if they could have had their way, they would have killed 10 times that amount, mm-hmm. right? This is just population reduction. Mm-hmm. And just bear in mind something. Okay, you look at, now remember, we're in the post-911 world now. We know what our government is like, what it really is. Okay, well, when you think about the Vietnam War, what was really going on the other side of the equation? And that's the MKUltra counterculture, right? Mm-hmm. Now, think about how these two cultural elements are interacting, right? You've got drugs, sex, and libertine lifestyle being promoted at home, And overseas, you're giving people drugs and violence. Because believe me, the entire U.S. armed forces were narcotized. I mean, they have a lot of footage of this. I think they shocked me. One of the data he had was how many people died of heroin overdoses. I can't remember the name, but it was just enormous, like 5,000 or something, you know, 50,000 addicts. And you see, I don't think there's any distinction. I think that basically this generation was targeted. And if you really want to know what is going on, it's actually given to you or to posterity, because they recorded Gregory Bateson's his reasoning as to why the CIA had to be created, right? And he said, you know, we need the CIA because we can't really fight these full-scale world wars anymore. He didn't point out that, you know, in other words, to keep population reduced in the way we want it, certain groups being always genocided. He doesn't say that. He just says, you know, we can't fight these big set-piece wars anymore, so we need to develop ways to control the population with psychology, right? This is the argument that was given to Truman, and that's what he funded the CIA about. The Bateson statement is, you know, it's online. I paraphrased it, but I'm not exaggerating the gist of it. That's what it was.
Yeah, they created the Psychological Strategy Board.
So the thing is, what they do immediately is they set up the counterculture. They massively introduce, you know, LSD and worse into the communities. And then they find a place where they can actually fight a non-nuclear war, right? Where they can fight the good old-fashioned set-piece war where they send, you know, troops over the top to reduce population. You know, I knew a friend of mine. He was in one of the veterans group. I knew a couple guys. I actually get emotional when I think about this because I get so angry. But he told me, he was there for a year, and he said, you know, what they would do is they would send us out into the bush, and they would reduce the number that they would send out. I mean, if they would send out a couple hundred, and if there was no attack, they would send out 150. They kept reducing the number that they would send into the jungle till they got to the number that the Viet Cong would feel comfortable attacking, right? And he said that this was actually the policy that we were on. And they were told, well, we need to induce the combat in order to, you know, destroy the enemy. And the problem is that the enemy that was being destroyed was the American soldier, you know, who's getting traumatized psychologically, if not killed. So the Vietnam War, it just stinks. It stinks to high heaven. And it is no different than 9/11 or MKUltra, my mind. It's just another part of the operation.
Yeah, yeah.
Burns is supporting that whole thing with this cesspool of a video that he's done where he takes all of the emotion out of things so that people will not be angry, will just kind of accept it as history unfolding.
Yeah, almost like an act of God or nature or something. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, there's no one to blame. As if no one.
No blame. No. It's all just the fog of war, the fog of politics, the fog of war. Nothing is clear. It's all just a big mass of confusion. But when you look at the precision of 9/11, when you look at the precision of the creation of the counterculture, Tim, rest assured that what you got in with Vietnam was just as precise. Mm-hmm. It was just as precise. Anyone who would say anything other than that is just an idiot or lying. It was just as precise. These things are population culling devices, and they are also trauma-based mind control. They are shattering these people. Because why? Well, when they get back, they really aren't much of a political force. I mean, just think how many veterans of the war in Vietnam and in the Middle East war come back and commit suicide, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just an epidemic. It's like 50 a day or something. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, because if you're getting like 30, 50 people a day killing themselves, there's probably that represents a shattering of mind and soul of like a million people, you know, when you have that number killing themselves each day. So, you know, we are under attack, and, you know, part of the attack is this, you know, these videographers that basically are part of the way that the population is kept in a kind of medicalized state, like on meds is what I'm trying to say, that the video just makes them tranquil and lay, you know, just, oh, who, you know, it just can't really get much sense out of it, but I'm feeling really calm. And, you know, I had a cathartic moment where they play some patriotic stuff and you see the people saluting and here come the POWs back and the wives are embraced and, you know, life is good again. And gee, well, let's just move on. No anger and no awareness that just like with 9-1-1 and just like the counterculture, we were basically attacked by the political class, by the secret society. This was just a way to shatter the boomer, who was a generation that the secret society was worried about.
Yeah. I mean, you're correct that he begins the series, the documentary, with a big bright shining lie. I think is a book by that name about the Vietnam War. One big bright shining lie, but he says the war begun in good faith by decent people, out of faithful misunderstandings, American overconfidence and Cold War misunderstandings. Now I don't know what good faith was being exercised or practiced, and who were these decent people? Was it LBJ? Was it Curtis LeMay? Was it Robert McNamara? Was it McGeorge Bundy? And who are these people? You know, again, overconfidence and Cold War misunderstandings. Just history unfolding. No one is responsible for anything. Of course, just a cursory look at the history of the war itself. Vietnam itself was a former French colony. French were kicked out by the Japanese in 1941. Japanese occupied it for a little less than 4 years. Of course, Japanese surrendered. And Ho Chi Minh fought the Japanese occupation and was supported by the United States during the war. But then after the war, the U.S. reneged on its promise to give Vietnamese independence and reinstated the French for the better part of a decade. The U.S. Supported the French, actually financially supported their imperial project in Vietnam until, I guess, 1954, when Bien Dien Phu and the Eisenhower administration abandoned the French. And this is, I think, reflective of a policy of the secret society operating through the OSS, because it was that time that the OSS was trying to nudge the Corsicans out, the French out, to take over the heroin trade. The heroin and opium markets have been huge in Asia going back to the 1920s because it's the nationalist Chinese, Chiang Kai-shek, particularly after he was kicked off the mainland in 1949, even before that, was often a lot of his financing was supported by the opium trade, the international opium trade. Of course, that even goes further back to the British Empire and China and these things, how important opium played for the rise of the financial houses of Great Britain and the United States. After 1955, you have this agreement where the Paris Peace Accords, where there's a promise to hold an election to unify North and South Vietnam. See if South Vietnam is officially divided like Korea was, thus setting itself up for a perpetual conflict, for a civil war. It's a tailor-made or fomented or created civil war. It's a civil war from without, which is an oxymoron because the divisions are being created by an external power. This is the United States. So they never have an election, so they install this guy, Diem, who's a Catholic in a primarily Buddhist country. And this is until 1963. And he is assassinated a month before John F. Kennedy is assassinated. And then that brings us up to 63. Of course, the following year, LBJ is reelected as a peace candidate. In fact, the joke was when he ran against Barry Goldwater, the joke in 64, after 64 was, they told me if I voted for Barry Goldwater, who is considered the warmonger candidate, we'd be at war a year later. And I did vote for Barry Goldwater, and we were at war a year later.
You know? Yeah, I mean, LBJ was the Obama of the 60s. I mean, he was, you know, he was the juxtaposed to Barry Goldwater, who had attacked LBJ on the grounds of being weak on communism. But then as soon as, you know, he gets into office, LBJ starts, well, I mean, he was president, but, you know, the Vietnam War starts up and they have all of this, you know, pseudo torture of LBJ where he just can't figure out what to do. But by God, he just kept sending more and more troops in, even though he knows they're all going to get killed.
And of course, Lady Bird Johnson is heavily invested in Bell Helicopter.
Yeah, I mean, they were just making money hands over fist. I mean, if you look at the finances,
KBR and all that, yeah.
It's just it's just all, like you were saying, basically, it's just the opium trade, you know, in the modern world. I mean, it's just East Trading Company. I mean, all of the French, you know, all of the, it, you know, it's just it's a colony.
Yeah, but I mean, we have to look at it as sort of a, you know, helicopters, heroin, and of course, social alchemy, or, was going on, or reverse alchemy, turning gold into base metal, socially speaking. But up and through the 50s, it was more or less a CIA operation, drugs and these things. And they were, you had Lansdale, the Quiet American, supposed to be based on carrying out bombings and at the time undermining the French and taking over there. The heroin trade there, which is very lucrative. But then in the 60s, the agenda seemed to change because they had to expand the war, escalate the war, and go from advisors, a few thousand advisors, to hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops. And this, I think this coincided with a sort of a plan unfolding, was you needed, obviously, a CIA with operating in Indochina with a few thousand troops isn't going to cause the social upheaval in the United States. You're going to need a big war. You're going to need people being conscripted. You're going to need a lot of casualties. You're going to need the media transmitting the images back home, which is something you didn't have during the Second World War, not even during the Korean War, but now with satellite television. And the irony is a lot of people think that the media itself undermined the war effort. It was a critical of the war effort, but for the most part, it was supportive of the war effort with some criticism. But that criticism itself, because we both know the media is a mockingbird media, it did not... You needed some criticism of the media to foment the anti-war movement, which is, again, part of the dialectic, which you speak of, sort of the counterculture. You need the anti-war movement as a big part of the counterculture. And, of course, you also had the development of in the 1950s, of the drug culture promoted through another Skull and Bones operation, Time Life. And you have drugs being promoted, music being promoted, and the cacophonous rock music had to be there to help create the turmoil, because every story, every movie needs a soundtrack. And you couldn't have, you couldn't have the Everly Brothers. You couldn't have Elvis Presley and his type of music. You needed the Doors. You needed the Birds. You needed Jimi Hendrix. And you needed, the Laurel Canyon scene. And what's funny thing is you mentioned, of course, Jim Morrison, his father. But the whole Laurel Canyon scene and the connections that they had to the military and intelligence, the same. So, and they're all part of this counterculture movement. They're promoting the music, promoting the youth movement to oppose the war. But in order to oppose the war and create that this social alchemy, you needed a war to oppose, to create the turmoil.
Yeah, and a particular kind of war, you know, one that basically could be given with the right images so that the youth could really get made rebellious and accept the counterculture. I mean, you see how it works. The MKUltra counterculture is being, you know, developed in the United States, and it's just a completely insane meat grinding war with the draft is going on the other side of the Pacific. And this is driving people into the counterculture. Do you see my point?
Yes.
Is that the war was part of the MKUltra counterculture. That's really what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
It is their thinking is that broad and that strategic. You know, for the generation that's in the meat grinder, they don't have any, they have nowhere to turn. I mean, they're, you know, taking LSD here and getting shot with machine guns there, you know. So it's just a perfect situation for the crushing of a generation.
It was this time when the social engineers, the ethnographers, the psychologists working for the intelligence agencies went from, I guess you could say, small-scale dosing, like through Operation Midnight Climax, LSD, and distribution drugs, and they started, because they created a cultural environment with the music, with the youth culture. You have these rock festivals, which were sponsored by the intelligence agencies and the military. These are distribution networks. You know, you can look at the Grateful Dead. I think obviously we've talked about this many times, the Grateful Dead being more or less a mechanism for distribution and cultural change for drugs.
So they're just, for LSD culture. You know, that's what they were designed to do.
Yeah, and of course they're in Watts just when the riots break out.
I had people in my high school class attend the acid test in Watts that the Grateful Dead played at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it was the first time I'd ever heard about LSD. I think it was the summer between my junior and senior year. Some people in my class went to Watts for this thing because everyone had heard about, you know, the acid test. I mean, basically, it was being sold as a way you could have sex.
Mm-hmm.
Girls would be basically drugged out, so. You know, you should go to these things because it was better than the kind of beer sort of parties that 17-year-olds were attending in Civic Palisades, you know, and the kind of picayune, you know, teenage culture that we had. Here comes the Grateful Dead. This is really going to be sensational. And some of the more avant-garde who actually went. And that was the next year was the 66 through 67. And I mean, I think about a third of my high school class took LSD.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, you know, actual casualties. I'm not exaggerating. People in the hospital, whatnot.
And with Vietnam, the military mission in Vietnam, well documented now, there were agreements made between military officials, corrupt local officials and generals. I think Kai Pao was one, or Vang Pao, the Cambodian one, where he would raise a sort of a children's army, and he was paid with heroin.
Yeah.
And then it was sold in the area and distributed, and also transported back.
Sold to GIs. They were selling it, you know, internationally, but they were selling it straight to the GIs. Yeah.
And then deposited in the Nugent Hand Bank in Australia.
HBSC is taking all the deposits. I mean, I know a lot about this, or at least I don't know if I know, but I mean, I have a friend who's passed away, had a drug problem, but he became addicted to heroin during the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
He was a medic, and he said that he wouldn't even use any of the stuff that they would give him in the field packs. He said he would just use the heroin. He said it was more reliable for pain relief if someone got shot. And then, unfortunately, he became addicted. He's passed away. He's a really an interesting, smart guy. Another, you know, real classic, someone who could have had political impact and threatened the secret society because he was so smart. But his life had been totally marginalized and, you know, no family, drug problems his whole life. And then, you know, basically physically collapsed in his 50s.
Yeah, the toll of it. But again, what we're talking about here, the war itself, we treated the war as sort of a mistake based on good intentions, these things, hubris, you know, even just you could say politics in general. But no, there was a plan here that unfolded. And
again, I lost it, Tim.
Oh, can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. I lost it just for a second.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry.
So you had this unfolding in the 1960s. Now, what was going on in the country, because the Vietnam itself, of course, you have 58,000 troops die in combat and a lot more casualties. But of course, you have estimated 2 to 3 million Vietnamese die, which don't seem to get much attention. From what I understand, in Ken Burns' series or in most understandings of the war here, at least here in America. I mean, obviously, in the 1980s, a lot of films about, you know, the bitter Vietnam veteran was Rambo. Late 70s, you had the Deer Hunter, these things. And it's you're supposed to feel pity for the soldier, but never even think about the Vietnamese themselves, who were the victims of this stuff. And you had things like the Phoenix program in Vietnam, which was a policy, supposedly a counterinsurgency operation, that was meant to root out what they called the civilian infrastructure of the Viet Cong. Now, what that really means is you're waging war on peasants, because that's the civilian infrastructure. And what it really resulted in was a lot of, you know, tens of thousands of people being tortured and murdered. You had these local interrogation centers that were built. USAID actually paid for the phone batteries, generators rather, that were used to torture people with electricity. This is how these operations go. You have USAID being used to support torture in Vietnam through an aid program, which is a generator for phones. But you know, you can just weaponize it very easily because it produces electricity. You had architects building Pacific Architecture firm, I forget the name of it, that was building the interrogation centers, so these prefab interrogation centers and prisons.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a lot of people involved in this operation. It was very compartmentalized, and there's a lot of money, I guess, trading hands in this operation as well. But one of the more sinister operations of the Phoenix program was to terrorize the Vietnamese peasantry. Just to create a sort of paralysis. And this was the goal of the Phoenix part of this Phoenix operation, when they'd go in and they'd slaughter a village and create a kind of a grisly, gory scene and leave it behind. Of course, the men doing this, special forces, these things, are being trained by the CIA, being called from the regular army. They come home. And what do they do?
Yeah.
There is some speculation that in the late 60s, early 70s, you had the phenomenon of the serial killer here in the United States that would traumatize the nation, the 1970s and 80s into the 90s. And people like Dave McGowan wrote a book called Program to Kill. And he made a connection, very much the same way that he made a connection between some of these musical acts of the 1960s and Laura Cannon to military intelligence. There's also a strange connection between a lot of these serial killers and the military. And he seemed to think that it might have been the arrival of the serial killer on the American scene in the 1970s was an application of the Phoenix program domestically to atomize society, create fear,
been basically just another chapter of the Phoenix program. the terrorizing of the population to basically, you know, ask for more government policing.
Yeah.
If you look at the Masonic connections to the Jack the Ripper killings in London, mm-hmm. and how that was part of, you know, how the police in London became more predominant and Scotland Yard expanded, and a terrified population is just much easier to control, of course.
Yeah.
So when you look at the Phoenix program, I mean, what I think is most important about it is people can see that the Vietnam War and MK Ultra were basically all the same thing. You know, I mean, MK Ultra was just a chapter of the secret society, and so was the Vietnam War. The Phoenix program was developed using the psychological torture and interrogation technology that was absolutely being developed by the MK Ultra science guys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's just no question. In 63, I think they had the manual. It was called the Kubrick counterintelligence interrogation.
Mm-hmm.
It was given to the, you know, agents and in terms of how to extract information, right? But that was just straight from the Phoenix program, which was, you know, in Vietnam, which was straight from, you know, the MK Ultra guys. And then just as a, you know, just to point out how malevolent the secret society is, then the so-called School of the Americas.
Yeah.
You know, that, okay, well, that the Kubrick manual then turns up again. It was actually disseminated, and then I'm not exaggerating. This was actually documented. They actually they found the guide, you know, in 1983-84, and they changed the name of it to the Human Resources Exploitation Manual. I remember that because I love the euphemism, the Human Resource Exploitation Manual, which means let's learn how to torture people. Right? Let me show you how to do it. Human Resource Exploitation Manual. And this is given to, basically all the regimes in Latin America that are playing ball with United Fruit. And this was supposedly part of the war on communism. It was just a way to, you know, get these dictators basically in line with the technology that MKUltra had developed. And so when you then look at its application in Vietnam, you can see that, you know, they have been studying the human mind solely for the purpose of how to control.
Yeah.
That's what all of this stuff is. And when you see the Vietnam War, you see the Grateful Dead, or you see, you know, Operation Mockingbird, you know, where the free press is dissolved into this absurdity where you've got the government being in control of everything to control the sense of history. It's all just one system. It's just a big cesspool of secret society control over the population. You just scratch any of these people. I did just a little tiny bit of research because I was curious about McGeorge Bundy.
Right? Yes.
Because he's such a sinister little creep, you know?
You focus on these guys and you really get a sense of how the system works or just by focusing on their career.
You know, and that's 100%. I mean, this is the right way because, see, like McGeorge Bundy, you know, like, well, first of all, he's skull and bones. I mean, this is your clue, right? But you go into this guy and, you know, you see that he was, he somehow, I mean, just like John Kerry becomes the spokesperson for the Veterans Against the War, somehow McBundy gets placed as JFK's national security advisor. Mm-hmm. Bundy was the one who actually drafted the infamous NSC 273. And this was on the night before the assassination, which basically was a document that expanded the U.S. So-called intervention into Vietnam that JFK would never have signed, supposedly, but it was available for LBJ to authorize a week later. It had been written the day before. But the thing that now is so interesting is that I just had no idea this was actually happening. But at the actual moment of the assassination, Bundy basically became president. Now, this is, I mean, people think it's LBJ, but actually Bundy was the one who somehow was given control over the narrative. He was the one who briefed all of the JFK's airborne cabinet about what happened. In other words, a lot of these guys were actually in the motorcade, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some of them had opinions about what they had seen. But Bundy was there to give them the correct history. he told them, now this is actually documented, even though no diligence had been done. He told them while they were in the air, he said there was one assassin, name was Lee Oswald, and he was the only killer involved. And that they could guarantee that the shooter, he had shot him from the back. Now, that was actually given, the memos I believe are still in existence, that Bundy created these detailed memos, right? And he told him basically what to do. During this whole process of the transition, Bundy was really in charge of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bundy, his brother, another skull and bones guy, right? The like I'm saying, the stench of the secret society. Now, his brother was William Bundy. I bet you'd never heard of him. I hadn't. He was, guess what he did? Whereas McGeorge Bundy is telling the airborne cabinet about what happened in Daley Plaza, right? He's creating the narrative. William Bundy is the one who created the official explanation of what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin.
Oh.
Isn't it amazing?
That is amazing.
It's just incredible. So you can see that the stench of the secret society, right, is just everywhere. The Phoenix program, JFK's assassination, the control over the information in the Gulf of Tonkin. And so when you look at this just, I don't want to use obscenities, but this pablum that this Ken Burns guy comes up with, the right response is to, you know, become angry. You know, we have to not allow them to narcissize us with this obvious brain heroin that they're able to inject into us, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all that Burns, and incidentally, Burns is a relative of Robert Burns, the Scottish bizarre Freemason. And if you've ever read my analysis of Khetra Narai, you know what I think about this guy. So mm-hmm. the fact that this Burns is a later generation is hardly a surprise to me. But anyway, we can't let them turn off our soul, because that's really what Burns is doing. I mean, he's disconnecting all human, you know, spiritual and emotional connection to our history.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see this thing and it's like, oh my God, it was a mess. I feel terrible about it. And let's just have dinner.
And the important thing, George Bundy also, he went, I think, from the NSC to the CFR to the Rockefeller Foundation.
Yeah.
To the Ford Foundation, I think.
The Ford Foundation, yeah.
And where he funds the Black Power Movement and also the Civil Rights Movement. So he's
they just keep us fighting. See, yeah. I mean, this in our show, I had quite a bit of correspondence. Incidentally, I evidently some people were quite upset, and also some were very supportive. But I got a lot of, you know, I guess I had touched some of the hot buttons, you know, in our discussion, and I'm, you know, kind of I get a lot of correspondence, I think, it having to do basically from Caesar's Messiah. Mm-hmm. So I'm just on people's list of someone to be angry at, or, you know, our support, you know. And so I get these responses.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of people believe what we were talking about, that the dialectic, right,
mm-hmm.
is deliberate. That, you know, the black kids, you know, the rap youth culture is being maneuvered basically into like a gladiatorial pit.
Well, it's similar to what happened in the 60s.
Yeah.
I mean, if they did it in the 60s to the majority white population,
yep,
with the music,
exactly,
of Vietnam,
right,
War, the 80s and the rap music. Of course, if you're familiar, anyway, we've discussed this in the past. I discussed with E. Michael Jones about the breakup of the Black Jewish Alliance in the 1960s. And at that point that the Hollywood started producing the blaxploitation films, promotion of the rap culture, at the same time, in support of another intelligence operation less developed countries like Central America, they're importing cocaine to pay for the operation. The cocaine is finding its way, with the help of the CIA, into places like South Central LA, where it's refined or producing crack cocaine, very cheap drug. But the
right.
media dutifully reports that crack cocaine is very cheap and three times as powerful.
Yeah, thanks a lot. You know, you're being very responsible by pointing that out on the front page so that all of the kids can read it. And then, you know, then suddenly crack is just beyond epidemic. And now notice the meme now is the heroin. You know, I mean, it just seems like there's just news stories everywhere. But they just talk about how easy it is to get. You know, it's just clear that they've got this idea that they'll, you know, increase the population, because you've also got this weird meme about calmness, right? Keep calm and carry on, you know, that you just see popping up all over the place. And I just think it's all part of the Brave New World tranquility, you know, that,
yeah.
And, you know, you can watch, you know, take Oxycontin and watch Ken Burns documentary on Vietnam.
Yeah, whatever emotions you're feeling, they're bad. You're not supposed to have emotions.
Exactly.
There's never a question whether or not these emotions are typically perfectly natural and healthy response to circumstances. You know, but if you take drugs and dull yourself with drugs.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're upset because if you don't know it, but you're upset because you've been enslaved.
Yeah.
You see, and the conditions of your slavery is that you are isolated from your family, from producing a family, from your ethnicity. These are the conditions of slavery.
Don't eat meat. Eat a lot of grain. Don't have babies.
Don't worry about diabetes because, you know, you can just go to Costco and they'll give you drugs for that.
And we all have health insurance. If they don't, if they don't, they shoot you.
Yeah.
If you don't use it.
I mean, the emotion that is Ken Burns is trying to quash is basically the energy that someone who has been enslaved by these conditions would experience as the method to resist.
Yeah, and there's a sense that we treat it like a tragedy because it's treated as an American defeat. After all, we saw the helicopters escaping from the U.S. Embassy in April 1975, the fall of Saigon. This is treated as a ignominy of defeat and this humiliation of American power, the waning of American power. But really, that's how it's portrayed. But the secret society had made a lot of money. They had achieved what they wanted to achieve. They had totally disrupted American society, corrupted it by the 1970s. That was the hangover from the 60s, but that was the result. That was the expected result of the excesses of the 60s. Yeah, but my point is, what happened in Vietnam? We were talking about North Vietnam won the war, it was unified, but now Vietnam is fully integrated in the New World Order. They're making T-shirts for you go to Walmart. And there's T-shirts made in Vietnam, know, and they destroyed local agriculture. The country's still polluted, and now I think they have to import food now, what they didn't have to prior to that. So they, which is one object of the wars, one object of these wars, the New World Order in general, is to destroy competing cultures that are outside the matrix, outside the corporatist Borg, so to speak. But I was listening to Doug Valentine talk about the war, and he had that take on it, that they wanted to destroy Vietnamese traditional culture. That's what all these wars do. They destroy traditional cultures. But he's talking about the Phoenix Program. He goes, the Phoenix Program's organizational structure became the template for the worldwide bloody operations, among them the Salvadorian option, undertakings throughout South and Central America, the Middle East, and later the War on Terror, the greatest covert op ever. And the Phoenix became the conceptual model for the Department of Homeland Security, as both are based on the principle that governments can manage societies through implicit and explicit terror.
Yeah.
So, but again, we're talking about the drugs, and I have a slight little, I have a list here.
Well, also the attack on ethnicity and family production. I mean, I'll bet that if you looked at the baby boomer, the demographic potentials before the war and then after, I mean, on one side you have, the youth culture. On the other side, you have the army with the problems that our soldiers experienced during that war.
Yeah,
I'll bet you the family production was, I mean, if I had to guess, Tim, I'd say it was 1/10 of what would have been anticipated.
That's right. You had the baby boom leading into the 60s and dying out in 60. I guess the last year of the baby boom was 1964, oddly enough, right? And this also coincides with the destruction of the ethnic neighborhoods through, through weaponized integration, urban renewal, the interstate highway system, mass entertainment. And really,
weaponized feminism was starting at this point. I mean, they were hitting us from all different angles at that point.
And with if you had traditional at old ethnic neighborhoods with the inherent suspicions of centralized power, these things as opposed to the bland, deracinated white middle class loyal Americans, perhaps you couldn't get the mobilization for the war. I mean, that's one of the reasons why in the run up to the Second World War there was so much concern over Irish, ethnic Germans and Polish population, these things, because there was a sense that these people weren't loyal Americans, and so they had to make war on these communities and homogenize the country, so the oligarchs who control the country could have their American century.
I think that the ethnic communities were targets of the oligarchs because they wanted those particular ethnicities shattered.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you're looking at, with like the Muslim immigration into Europe, the weaponized immigration, is just another phase of all of this, the European culture was targeted. The ethnic communities were simply the last, really the strongest bastions of European ethnic, organization in the United States. And so that's why they came up with the weaponized integration against them. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, obviously, I mean, look at the biggest thing is the one of the largest, I guess the most significant part of this was the facilitation of the drug trade through these wars. And I mean, just in the 20th century, we mentioned Alfred McCoy has a book called The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. That's about how the Vietnam War was used as a cover to facilitate the heroin trade out of the Golden Triangle. The Nugent Hand Bank was established in Australia to launder the money, same with HSBC, which had been established in the 19th century for the opium trade. In the 1970s and 80s, you have Panama and Central America. This is primarily cocaine. And then in the 80s again, you have Afghanistan. And then in the after 2001, September 11th, you have again Afghanistan again being a huge production or area, or at least the poppy fields that are supplying the demand for heroin internationally again. And every time you see one of these military intelligence operations, you have an explosion in the narcotics trafficking.
I know, it's shocking, isn't it?
I mean, you start to see a pattern here.
Yeah, like we have a pretty clear-cut pattern. So, with Vietnam, I think the hope I would have is that if people listen to the show, they look at this Ken Burns, his documentary series, and they would at least have the suspicion, hopefully, that they're looking at very particular kind of propaganda. And what they want is for your soul to simply fade to gray. Mm-hmm. But I would hope people could resist that, and that the blaze of anger wouldn't be extinguished, because that is the energy that we have to, develop in order to create some organization with which we can resist these programs. I think that studying the MKUltra program, studying weaponized feminism, studying weaponized integration, all of these things help clarify the nature of the secret society. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what's really important to me. I mean, this is what I hope our show is able to do, and I just hope all of the different shows that are on the internet, people trying to get sort of an understanding of culture. I think that this is really what the focus should be, is to get a really clear sense as to what is the secret society, what is the deep state, who are they, right? How does it stay in existence? When you look at the family connections, I mean, I was talking about how when you just scratch the surface, you get into all of this, you can't go anywhere other than into the secret society structures. So if you look at Bundy, he basically replaced someone who had gotten into his name was Kissel, I think his name was. And it turns out he was another Skull and Bones guy, and he got Kennedy fired him. I think he didn't get along with his idea about the Cuban,
missile crisis.
That was going to happen. And so his name was Bissell. That's right.
Richard Bissell.
Richard Bissell.
Like an old Skull and Bones family. Yeah.
He was absolutely big Skull and Bones family. Yeah. But see, what was so interesting is that when I looked into the guy, he was also in what was called the Georgetown section, which had this kind of informal study group.
Right? Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was known as the Georgetown Set.
Yeah, yeah.
And I bet you, because I know you've grown up around there, you might have known it.
What's her name? Is the town? It was like the Katharine Graham, right? And all that.
Exactly. That see, crowd, this is what is just fascinating is that all of these, you can see how the, and again, I'm trying basically to flesh out that we can actually identify these people with some research, because when you go into Kissel, then you can see that, wait a second, he's in this Georgetown set. And then you look at these guys and it's nothing but OSS and media people. You've got the Alsop brothers.
Yeah.
Graham on one side, and then you've got Harriman, McCloy, Felix Frankfurter, right? And then, of course, Alan Dulles. But the name that I really was fascinated by, the relationship, was that Cord Meyer was in this.
Yes.
Now, Cord Meyer is another Skull and Bones family, but you see, he's the one that ran Gloria Steinem's operation.
Yes.
He's one and then creates, you know, Ms. Magazine, and you know, he actually manages Gloria as an agent.
Yeah, the Congress of Culture of Freedom and all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly right.
Fake culture. There. Yeah, fake culture.
Yeah, and then he's there with his protege to, like, basically arrange the funding and the publicity for Ms. Magazine. Well, Tim, I just don't think these kinds of social connections can possibly be accidental.
Yeah, and of course, his ex-wife is supposedly having an affair with John F. Kennedy, and of course, she is also friends with Timothy Leary, I believe.
Tim Leary, right. And so now you're right into the MKUltra counterculture. And then you have, you know, the if you look at the wives of these people, again, it's just this secret society cesspool. There's just, you know, if you know these, like Annie Bissell and the infamous Catherine Meyer, who basically was one of the people who ran Operation Mockingbird to take control over the, you know, the media. So that then you could later on put on things like Ken Burns.
Yes. You
know, narcissized, you know, explanation of Vietnam War.
Perception management, create reality.
Perception management, right.
I mean, that's the big
thing. So this is the thing, is that we should never let the war, the Vietnam War, know, leave our hearts as something that, you know, doesn't engender, you know, a lot of passion.
Richard Bissell, I think it was, he was canned or sacked by Kennedy along with Alan Dulles and General Cabell, who's the brother, was the mayor of Dallas, Texas, when Kennedy was assassinated.
Oh, and, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're all canned, they're all sacked after the Bay of Pigs, the Bay of Pigs fiasco, supposedly.
Yeah, and obviously this led to JFK's assassination.
Yeah, because that's when Dulles was sacked. Yeah, I mean, that's something else. I mean, of course, you get that whole set. Of course, you're with Katharine Graham. She goes back to the Meyer family, which was an old Jewish banking family, the Federal Reserve. He was in the first, I think, governors of the Federal Reserve Board was Meyer, her father, gets into banking and these things. It's a real cesspool of elite degenerate.
Yeah. Degenerate. And then it's like Dulles, you know, who was kicked out and, all right, because of his, I guess he ran afoul with Kennedy, you know, in the Bay of Pigs, but you just look into these guys because you see, like
Sullivan and Cromwell, and
yeah. But the Dulles family, they were in the it was the Society of Brothers in Unity. I've pulled it up here in my little notes, and that was basically the predecessor of Skull and Bones, Secret Society, and it was families who bought and sold slaves and opium. And they would have this contract work with British in India to, you know, trade tea for opium. I mean, this is the group then that becomes, you know, Harriman Brown, the Federal Reserve, and this group, of course, is completely wired into the Rothschild Masonic control, you know, on the other side of the Atlantic. Folks, we're just getting screwed here. You know, one generation after another that just keeps ratcheting up the slavery techniques. And we have to, while the internet is still standing, make some use of it to try to develop some resistance, some way that we can, you know, stop these people from finishing us off because that's exactly what I think is about to happen if we don't stand up to them.
Of course, then you mentioned the opium family, the opium trade, what it did to Chinese society in the 19th century.
Yeah.
And so, of course, you shoot ahead 100 years in the 1950s. You have the same club, Skull and Bones, promoting the drug use through their through mass media. And, of course, the development of mass media was huge because that's when you could get into mass mind control with mass media. And that's why one of the reasons why mass media was created was for the purposes of mass mind control and mass trauma.
I actually know a little kind of weird data about the development of mass media. It's something that surprised me when I uncovered it. You know, so you had the Fatty Arbuckle fiasco, and basically there was a lot of hue and cry against Hollywood mm-hmm. as being a Jewish plot against European culture. And at that point, you didn't have political correctness. So that was literally how it was being expressed. Right?
People would say it, yes.
Yeah, they would say it. And so they then developed the production code, which became known as the Hays Code. And this brought, you know, the Catholics, the Knights of Columbus, and some, the National Legion of Decency. Mm-hmm. And it brought these guys out as kind of the figureheads of the production code. And the production code was basically a way to preserve American culture. And if you look at it, you know, there was just, you know, there was no nudity. There was no interracial sex. There was no, you know, a woman couldn't, you know, sell her virtue. You know, I mean, none of this was permitted. So it was really kind of a defense of classic American European culture, right? Mm-hmm. That's how it's sold. The problem is that the guy who was brought in to run it was this guy Hays. I think his name was Wilbur Hays, I believe. Now, he was, you know, supposedly an Episcopalian, I believe is his religion. So he wasn't Jewish, but he was a Freemason. And as I've always said that, you know,
well, it's classic infiltration, right?
Yeah, exactly. Whenever you have one of these Christian guys who is a Mason, you always have to put a little asterisk next to the Christian, because what kind of a Christian would take these kinds of oaths? Well, there are no kinds of Christians, because I've seen, I think, as a legitimate initiation pledge that the Masons have, at least it was sent to me as such. And basically, it's an agreement to permit yourself to be murdered if you ever reveal any of their secrets. Mm-hmm. And this is not a high level, you know, oath. This is just one of the lower levels, but basically you're essentially giving them your life. You're saying, if I ever to say anything about what you guys are up to, well, you can't be a Christian and take that kind of oath.
No.
Because this totally, you know, transcends it. Well, anyway, now Hayes's background couldn't be worse because he had worked with Edward Bernays in the War is Good propaganda department to sell World War I to the American public. Now, remember, they brought out the poster which had a giant gorilla yep. in a German outfit holding a blonde, and, you know, with statements like, we have to stop the beast, right?
Premonitions of King Kong, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, anyway, so, hey, but what I was, my point is, is that Hays, even though he's not known, he's actually, in my opinion, third to like Edison and Tesla as far as the creation of the, you know, sort of what becomes mass culture. Because what he did was, is he's saying, well, we've got this production code, so you don't have to worry about there being any, you know, damage to culture from the Hollywood media. And what he did during this his control of it, is he established thousands of motion picture screens and places where Hollywood could actually reach. He got movie theaters into every little tiny town in America. He had hundreds of people that would work for him. They would go out and talk about, you know, we got to get electricity. You know, because he needed a lot of juice in order to, like, get one of the theaters up. He would talk about, we've got to have electricity because we need to get this great American entertainment into your little small town. So Hays, what he did was, under the cover of the code, he went out and he just completely infiltrated America with movie theaters. Now the code goes away, right? And of course, we know how the code goes away. It's, mm-hmm. you know, the pawnbroker comes mm-hmm. with nudity, and no one can say no to the pawnbroker because it's about someone who is a victim from the Holocaust.
Yes.
And oh my, well, we can't really stand up to this movie because even though there's naked breasts, you know, there's this other issue that is kind of intimidating, so we're not going to say much. And that's now the floodgates are open. And because Hayes had created mass media, basically, I think he's really the one who did it.
In the same way you can't criticize the promotion or peddling of pornography and point out who's primarily responsible for it without being accused of being anti-Semitic because of the Holocaust. Yeah,
yeah, it's the same. That's actually the power of anti-Semitism. Yeah. I think most of the leverage comes from the Holocaust. It's the prime moving, you know, device in it. And so that's why when we've done shows where we talk about the propaganda, the obvious propaganda that has been produced out of it, I think this is really going to, you know, set people in the wrong way in a lot of cases because they're so well, you know, established.
And also how the Holocaust went to reinforcing, I guess, cementing Jewish identity, while at the same time great efforts have been made to destroy any other competing ethnic identity.
Sure. And particularly, of course, German identity, which was the premier European identity.
Yeah.
I mean, it just got crushed. I mean, bear in mind that where the information about the German people comes from following World War II
yes.
is Ewan Cameron. This makes a lot of sense, right?
Ewan Cameron is telling
us, well, this is what the German people are like. Well, he's, you know, keeping human beings in chemical comas for months at a time and giving them electroshock to drive their memory out.
Right. Hollywood directors like Billy Wilder are propagating the Holocaust narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, that's the thing is that when you trace, you know, like C.P. Jackson, I think it is, you know, he's like the Time Life editor, was there with the
C.D. Jackson, yeah.
the human lampshade lamp and the shrunken heads that are straight from the Amazon jungle.
Yeah, just ridiculous.
Right. And this is what people who come into the camp see. The very first thing are these absolutely absurd Hollywood props that are just completely fake.
But they're already there
with the propaganda.
Yeah, think about the effect of the newsreel before the war. In these movie theaters that Hayes helped establish.
Right. So you can see it's all just one system. So Hayes gets the electricity and the theaters built, and now here comes the newsreel with the with the shrunken heads. I don't know if you've ever seen it, Tim, but if you get a chance, look at the shrunken heads that are on display when they come in. I think it's Buchenwald was the camp they come into it. And they actually show that C.P. Jackson and I don't know, some other OSS spook is standing there in back of the table. And I mean, the shrunken head, you're just going to roll with laughter. I mean, the guy looks like he's the most jungle creature you've ever seen in your life with his straight black hair going down about 6 inches. I mean, this is not a guy, this is not a European from a concentration camp. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But because there was no vetting of any information at this point, I mean, they were able to get away with it.
Well, how many viewers have actually seen a shrunken head?
Well, yeah, they had no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew it because I've worked in South America and I've seen them. I told you I've actually been in like Belém, in the Amazon where, you know, they have the weird stuff is for sale and you'd see them from time to time. But so I knew it. I knew immediately what they were. I was looking at. But the people who were there showing in the newsroom. But, you know, back home, the Hays Code has been in effect, and now every little tiny town in America has got their, propaganda theater all set up, ready to roll, you know. It's a system of domination, of intellectual control. We really don't know where we are. We only know one thing, Tim. We are not where they tell us.
No.
I mean, we don't know where we are in terms of, you know, the structure of slavery or what our government is really about to do to us or, you know, what all of these things mean or how did the war come about. All we know for sure is what they tell us is complete nonsense. It's all designed as a weapon.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And it would be good if mass communication was there to, you know, provide us information that we can't get ourselves because we're stuck in one area, one location at a time. But obviously there's great power to that, and there's people who harness that power are not going to use it for benevolent reasons. They use it for manipulation. And that's, you know, I mean, I had one guy talk about prior to the distribution of films in the 1930s is that no one had ever seen a movie star before, a face of a movie star. You know, they just, or the magazines, whereas your idea of what people look like would be the people in your small town, and that was it. But then the creation of the celebrity, the movie star, all of a sudden, your whole perception has changed, and your outlook on life is different, and there's an incredible power in that. And you create, this is, of course, is a stepping stone creating a consumerist culture, you know. The creation of these theaters in every little small town was, it's the same way that, you know, Leon Trotsky went around with his traveling with his projector and film, and he on rail cars showing peasants film.
And remember, though, like in Laurel Canyon during World War II, they had a secret military base. The thing was gigantic. You know, it's like 5 acres or something. It was the largest underground facility in Los Angeles.
Yeah, Lookout Mountain.
On Lookout Mountain.
Air Force Base.
And they had all of these major Hollywood, you know, producers and stars, right, that were actually in attendance. Walt Disney, Billy Wilder.
Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah, okay. So they got all these guys up there. Yeah. But you can see how important the control of the media was, that they were actually, at that point, so organized about trying to study the effects of film, because that's obviously what they're doing. They had as a cover story that they were going to take pictures of the nuclear bomb, and that's why they had to keep it quiet, you know, like secret. Yeah, that's why you have Walt Disney and Marilyn Monroe, right, to do pictures of them. So this is absurd. So they are obviously studying. You know, and what does Monroe do? Well, Monroe does pornography,
and right?
That's basically what she is. And so this is what was being studied up there. And this is then, you know, when you get the pawnbroker and you start to move pornography out. It's just like you say, they had,
or just the whole creation of the blonde bombshell.
Oh, sure, exactly.
If you think about it, it's absurd.
Yeah,
I mean, even the blonde bombshell isn't the blonde bombshell. She's a flesh and blood human being. But nevertheless, create this image. And of course, Marilyn Monroe was bigger. And of course, just this past week, you've had the passing of Hugh Hefner, who just serendipitously
piece of crap. God, if only he died at like 60 years earlier, 90 years.
But I'm reading all this adulation about how he freed America and all this stuff, and through his and what's sick about this is that at one time Playboy was revolutionary. Now it's an anachronism. Well, is that progress? Is that progress that now it's tame compared to what every 13-year-old boy has at his fingertips? So the internet, the pornographic culture they've created.
Thanks Wilbur Hayes, because I mean, as I said, he's little known, but he actually is the one who did it. He's the one who took the visual media, which was being, for only one purpose, was control. There's a really, like, there's actually an important quote that Hayes brought up, and it was pointed out to me by Sophia Smallstorm, who's a internet researcher that I was talking with. And she, when we were talking about the Hayes Code, she pointed out that, you know, Hayes is supposed to be, you know, completely watching pornography, right? He's supposed to not letting it come into the film. And they quoted Hayes talking to a director, and he was saying, and he told the director, the quote was, you know, it's not like how low the dress goes to cover the knees of a woman. It's basically, it's how the camera, you know, takes in the moment as a way that's exciting, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, he was showing him the subtleties of pornography. In fact, Sophia said that this must have been the basis for the Sharon Stone genital exposing,
Basic
Instincts, because it was literally I mean, it was basically, but the important thing was, and I'm not quoting Hayes right. I'm sorry, I don't have the quote in front of me, but I got the gist right. But the point is that Hayes is supposed to be controlling to make sure that there is no pornography. And this was an absolutely clear cut example of actually he's getting us ready for pornography. Mm-hmm. You see, so you can see that, you know, what we have today.
Well, like seven-year itch. Wasn't that Billy Wilder?
It was Billy Wilder. Yeah, the famous Marilyn Monroe scene where she's, you know, she goes over the grate and mm-hmm. her dress starts to billow up and then you know the camera just lingers on her whole struggle to make sure that her panties don't get exposed. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, Monroe's scene was, you know, almost a perfect representation of the psychological, you know, structure that Hayes was describing. Mm-hmm. Is that it basically would elicit more kind of male brain focus on Monroe's genitalia than anything else you could do, right? Because mm-hmm. the way that Wilder structured. And of course, you know, sad to say, but then Wilder is off to Buchenwald to film the fake Holocaust films, so that then the propaganda just comes right back on the other side. And it's really kind of funny, isn't it? I mean, when you think of like the Pawnbroker, which Preminger did, it wasn't Wilder, but, you know, so if you control the media, you can control the mm-hmm. minds to a large extent of the people that you're exposing it to. So, you know, you had talked about how the information is, you know, so difficult for our media, the real media, to get out. But you know something, Tim? That was before Tim Kelly came onto the scene. It's one of those like enter, you know, everything is dark and gloomy. Enter Tim Kelly, because you know you're so encyclopedic and with really good data and you know you position it well. And so you know, I mean, I think we can start opening minds up pretty darn quick here. My sense is, could be wrong about this, just small sample size, but I can kind of sense, Tim, can kind of sense it. There's a little bit of a groundswell, and I don't think it's going to stop. I don't think it's going to stop because I think there are just too many people now talking openly about it, mm-hmm. that there is a secret society, that it does control us through the media, that it is poisoning us with the food, that it is slaughtering us with the fake wars. And I don't think this is going to stop. So, you know, they may end us, which would be sad, but I don't think they're going to end the movement, because I think it's already past the point where they can control it. I actually believe that. I know this may seem crazy, and I'm often accused of being that, which is a person's right to have, and I can understand, you know, given my... like my background in scholarship, I mean, people, you know, and I'm just going to make a little joke, but I mean, just wanted to make the point that I think the groundswell is too, you know, I think it's actually starting to get geometric. So mm-hmm. this is going to be an exciting 10 years, in my opinion. And so I just wanted to say that, you know, because my first book was sort of like a completely different interpretation of the Gospels, you know, and mm-hmm. I was saying, well, it's actually, you know, you just don't kind of get how the literature works. And then my next book was, well, Shakespeare is completely misunderstood, and there's actually another interpretive framework, so you're just missing the whole thing. And it's like I get emails like, well, you are absolutely whacked. There is no question. You know, it's like this, you know, I go, well, it may be, but I just, you know, I call them like I read them. So what I'm seeing is as I'm reading this stuff, I'm really sensing that people are getting it. And, you know, I don't know what fraction of the population has to really get it before it because here's my point. This isn't going to trend. See, this is the thing. I know they're aware of this. Tim, it will not trend. What will happen is you'll get a tipping point. You're going to get like maybe 5% of the population is absolutely, you know, clear-minded and pissed. And then when you get to that point, the next 60 days from there, it's going to be 50% of the population. Because what will happen is when there's enough people that are clear-minded and angry and operating and trying to desperately get people to pay attention, what's going to happen is the intimidation will crack. You see, what keeps us, you know, frozen in place is not that we're morons. It's just that there is intimidation, right? You know, they're just they keep like the sense of reality. And that's what you have things like Ken Burns is. It's just to create this sense of reality of like, well, if I don't really believe, you know, any of this, but if I say something, it's, well, you'll see. Once there's like 5% of the people that are pissed and talking, in 30, 60 days, there'll be half of the population and the whole thing will collapse. So going to be an exciting time, Tim, I'm telling you. I can see it.
Well,
I'm a visionary. I can see it. It's out there.
The big question is how many football players are going to kneel during the national anthem this Sunday?
Well, you know, one interesting thing. I don't know. Have you ever actually looked at the national anthem, all of the entire song?
I've never liked it.
Well, it's a horrible song.
Yeah.
I mean it should absolutely be done away with. I mean, the thing is just sickening. It's a big Masonic, you know, kill everybody kind of thing.
It's like a battle hymn of the Republic.
Well, I know, which is but it's actually it's even worse now. Now the thing is, which is so interesting, is that what people don't know is there's actually another. We sing the one little weird stanza, which doesn't make much sense, but you know, it's about killing a lot of people.
Yeah.
But do you know there's actually more stanzas?
No, I didn't know.
Yeah, there is, and I'll just read. I'll read them like here's like one of my favorite lines. Now, and where is that band who so vauntingly swore that the havoc of war and the battle's confusion, a home and a country, should leave us no more? Their blood has washed out their foul footsteps' pollution. No refuge could save the hireling and slave. Now, let me explain that. Is it all right? Give me just a few seconds.
Oh, right. Yeah, go ahead.
So what happens is, okay, so you've got, I think it was like the War of 1812 or something.
Yeah, that's when he wrote it. Yeah,
okay, so Keyes is a slave owner, of course, and the British made an offer, or maybe, I forget, maybe it was a Canadian, but anyway, whoever we were fighting at the time makes an offer. And so they said, look, if you're a slave or one of these indentured servants, the hirelings, we'll free you. All you got to do is give us money. We'll give you money. So they were saying that they would, if you would fight against the Americans, when we won, we would give you money and freedom. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of blacks and the so-called hirelings, which were like indentured servant blacks, they took up the offer and fought against America, right? For as kind of an inside, you know, third column, like, mm-hmm. you know, force. So when he writes the song, he's laughing at him. He goes, you know, their blood washed out their foul footsteps pollution, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, the blood of the slaves who tried to fight for their freedom that we killed and shot, their blood washed away their foul footsteps pollution. And there's no refuge that could save the hireling and the slave. Okay, well, that's great, Francis Scott. I really like your like open-mindedness and humanity here. This is great. You know, you'd be a great guy to write a national anthem because you're a Masonic maniac, like a genocidist. But when I think of like the black guys in the NFL, a lot of them are like actually descendants of slaves.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if anyone has ever pointed out to them that, you know, when they sing the song, you don't want them to sing the next stanza because you might get a little bugged about it because that's your blood, buddy.
Yeah.
And it's saying your foul footsteps pollution, right? And no refuge can save you. Now here's the kicker. There's a kicker. You see, I got a sense of humor. I'm not such a, you know, like, I'm fun at parties. Okay. Here's my point is that, so you have the military is paying the NFL money so that the current crop of slaves will stand there during the national anthem because the military was running out of like people to send to the wars to slaughter. So they created a campaign where they gave the NFL like $25 million so that they would put the players on the field during the national anthem because they were going to create this promotional recruiting video, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they that's why then, because before 08 or 09, the players were always in the locker room. They would come out after the national anthem. But no. So the Army gives the NFL all this money. Now the players have to come out, right?
Mm-hmm.
But here's my point. So the thing that if I was like a black NFL guy, that would really piss me off is that I would be standing for the anthem celebrating my ancestors' blood fighting for freedom, washing away their foul footsteps pollution for a promo piece so that they could go out and hire my cousins to then go over the Middle East and get blown up.
Yep.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a daisy chain of genocide, and I can only laugh at it because I would cry if I actually, you know, stopped and, you know, let my humanity express itself, because that is just, you know, this is just a great example of the facade of patriotism in a great country, and in back of it is the secret society and genocide.
Well, Joe, if we're not throwing the flower of the country's youth into the meat grinder in some benighted far off country, you're just not, if you don't support that, you're just not a good American.
I guess, you know, I'm a terrible American.
And if we're not spending $1 trillion on the F-35 fighter, you're just not, if you don't like that, you're just a...
Well, the F-35 flyers will fly over the NFL. I mean, they cover the whole stadium in a flag.
Yeah.
And they bring out these guys. And you know, it was interesting. I saw like some of the original photo stuff of like Colin Kaepernick's kneeling.
Mm-hmm.
Which incidentally was weirdly coincided with 9/11, but at the event they actually had Kaepernick on his knee, which is kind of weird as a protest that you would kneel. But
yeah.
Sonic, but anyway, I don't like it. But then they had next to it in the video that they were producing, they had like a guy in a Marine outfit and he was standing, but he had no legs. They had him kind of propped up like he was in a wheelchair, but they somehow had a device so he could stand up. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was thinking, I was going, wait a second. Am I looking at the recruitment video? Right. Is that what this is? And you see what I mean? In other words, I mean, I don't know Colin Kaepernick. I have no idea, you know, if he would, you know, could have been manipulated like that. But it just struck me, knowing why the players were supposed to be there, that and then seeing this original vignette where they have Kaepernick on his knee and the Marine standing but with no legs.
Yeah,
I don't know.
And I suppose you're supposed to be, because the Marine has no legs. Presumably, he lost them in combat or some.
Yeah.
On patrol, perhaps in some country where he shouldn't have been. But if you point that out, you're trivializing or you're besmirching his so-called sacrifice for the country.
You're not honoring the first responders.
Yeah. Yeah.
The first responders are the SWAT team.
Yeah.
And I think they're coming in my door right now. So I have to. Oh, man. Hey, buddy.
Okay.
It's been great.
Thanks, Joe.
I just wanted to close by. I better not. I was going to try to sing the stanza, but I'm not going to. People can just imagine in your mind. Imagine me singing. You know, a home and a country should leave us no more. Their blood has washed out their foul footsteps pollution. No refuge could save the hireling and slave, and the hireling and slave. Oh, that's us.
Yeah. And the whole country is obsessed with this kneeling issue.
Yeah, that's right. We got to get this fixed and forget about the technologic snooping and the wars in the Mideast and the Federal Reserve extracting the wealth of every American.
Yeah, a toxic food food supply, toxic medicine.
Man.
So. Okay, well, Joe.
You know, let's organize and I think it's happening. I actually sense courage, Tim. I think that I could be wrong. Hope I'm not, but I sense it. I can sense it. I can feel it. Courage is starting to appear. They try to stop it, you know, and Ken Burns and Billy Wilder and all of the video representations and the BS, New York Times, all this. But now the population, there's too many people, I think, that are getting it. And courage is happening, my friend. So anyway, next week we're going to be even braver and funnier.
You remember when Dan Rather signed off with his newscast, Courage?
Yeah, what did he do? What did that Masonic cesspool do?
Don't you remember, for a while, he used to sign off his newscast, Courage.
Oh, right, Courage.
Back in the 80s or something. Right?
Yeah, Courage. Yeah,
once
thanks,
or twice
Dan.
And stopped doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well.
He's the one that said the head moved forward, remember? JFK, the film.
Thanks, Dan. All those guys are just a big clump of secret society, talking heads. They're everywhere. Their roster is deep. You know, it's probably a couple hundred thousand people, and they got the media, the financial system. But man, there's a lot of people that are not in the guild, and a lot of these guys are, They hear this like our blood will wash out our foul footsteps pollution and there's no refuge to save us slaves. Nah, I don't think they're going to like it. I think they're going to resist. So anyway, next week, Tim.
Okay, take care. Enjoy the weekend.
All right, brother. Thanks for the talk.
Bye-bye.
Talk to you next week. Bye-bye. Thank you.